Hey folks, Rob Wolf here. Episode 151 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. In my house, sitting next to me, I have the infamous Chris Kresser bringing up property values on this podcast instead of bringing them down. Chris, what's going on?
Not much. Good to be here in the Wolf Den. Beautiful day outside, and happy to be here again with you, Rob.
Nice, man. So Greg is on vacation one more week, and then we'll have Greg back. We had an opportunity to hang out with Chris, and when's the last time we had you on the podcast?
It's been several months. I can't
almost a year.
Yeah, maybe a year.
So what's new? What's cooking?
Well, you know, always something cooking.
Oh, I forgot. One minute. I keep forgetting our sponsor, Evolve Foods, sponsor of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Obviously, Slapdick is always on this thing. Evolvefoods.com, put in Wolfpack, I think with a capital W. I'm not 100% sure on that. Wolfpack 12, and you'll get a 15% discount on your order if you choose to buy something. If not, that's good too. Okay, Chris, you were saying.
That was pretty smooth, Rob.
Thank you.
Good morning. I've got to hire you for my promos.
Yeah, probably a bad idea.
Well, you know, let's see. Sylvie is 14 months and walking around terrorizing, as you can see.
Yep.
So that's been fun and a little challenging at times too. Just trying to take care of myself and stay healthy and keep putting stuff out there.
Nice. So you released the personal paleo code about 6 months ago?
Yeah, that was in November of last year.
Okay, so coming up on a year already.
Almost a year. And then just now, the high cholesterol action plan.
So what, my latest. And you talked to me maybe 5 months ago about this idea for the high cholesterol action plan. What was kind of the seed for that? Like, I get questions frequently about folks have gone on paleo. They feel better. They have some blood lipid parameters improve, but then sometimes things don't look as good.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I get the same thing. I probably get more questions about cholesterol than anything else.
Okay.
And I think we have, you know, a readership and an audience that's way more educated about cholesterol than the mainstream. And yet it's still a really confusing issue.
Right.
Even as much as people know, as much as we've learned about it, there's still a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions out there. And even in my own family and friends, you know, people go to the doctor, they get diagnosed with high cholesterol, and they don't really know, and they get prescribed a statin, and they don't know what to do. You know, should they take it? Is it really something to be concerned with? They've probably heard some idea, you know, in the paleo and primal community that high cholesterol maybe isn't as much of a concern as we once thought it was. But there's so much, you know, there's some pretty powerful conditioning around that we've all had for years and years. And I think it's pretty hard to just set it aside and ignore it.
Yeah. And so, like, you were talking yesterday, and like we kind of have two camps, kind of the mainstream, and we have Dean Ornish on the front page of was it the New York Times?
New York Times. Yeah.
And you know, still decrying red meat and recommending high carb, super low fat, you know, intervention as like the way to go. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of this, we have this kind of paleo primal community where folks have said blood cholesterol has absolutely no bearing on cardiovascular disease. The higher, the better is almost the sentiment. And where do you feel like the truth is in that whole story?
That's a great question. I mean, the way I think about it is if we talk about two ends of that spectrum, on the one hand, we have what you might call the cholesterol believers. These are the folks like Ornish that you mentioned, and probably represented by the dominant paradigm, the mainstream doctors and organizations like the American Heart Association, American Diabetes Association, et cetera, who think that cholesterol is basically an evil nutrient, and we should do everything we can to get it as low as we possibly can. If we could get it down to zero, that would be ideal. You know, and they completely don't understand the important physiological roles of cholesterol, and that we would basically die without it. It's one of the main things that separates animal life from plant life is cholesterol.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then on the other hand, though, as you mentioned, we have what we might call the cholesterol skeptics, and these folks are represented by, you know, like the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics, Dr. Uffe Ravenskopf, and a few other pretty prominent folks. And their argument, I mean, there's actually kind of a diversity of opinion in that group, but the most extreme version of that argument is the one you just articulated, which is we shouldn't even bother measuring cholesterol. It's got nothing to do with heart disease, and let's just forget about it and move on. So there's a lot of problems with that, Rob. And one of the main problems is one of terminology, because when a lot of people say cholesterol, what they're actually referring to are the lipoproteins that carry the cholesterol around. And I think we need to just like step back and cover this basic point before we go on, because it's going to be pretty important to the rest of the discussion. So the easiest way to explain it is that if you imagine that your bloodstream is like a river, then you have boats on the river. The boats are lipoproteins, and these are like LDL, low-density lipoprotein, HDL, high-density lipoprotein, VLDL, very low-density lipoprotein. And these lipoproteins travel around the bloodstream. They transport cholesterol, but also triglycerides and fat-soluble vitamins and antioxidants. So they're basically like shuttles that carry nutrients all around the body to places they need to get to. So if the lipoproteins are the boats, then the cholesterol would be the cargo in the boat. So a lot of the misunderstanding that we have about this debate comes from just a problem with nomenclature or terminology. And people, when they say cholesterol, they're not actually referring to the cargo in the boat. They're talking about the boats themselves. So what we know now is that both ends of that spectrum are wrong, and that the evidence really is more in the middle. And you can have high cholesterol, which means a large amount of cargo in those boats, and be at very low risk for heart disease. And you can have low cholesterol, which means not very much cargo in those boats, and be at high risk for heart disease.
So when people are doing a standard blood panel, what is it that they are typically getting, and how does that relate back to like the, you know, cargo versus boats?
Right.
Like what is it that you know, you go to your doc, you get a basic blood panel. What is it that blood panel is typically telling
right.
them? And what is it not telling them?
Sure. And this is the problem with the standard lipid panel, is that the standard lipid panel is only measuring the cargo in the boats, not the number of boats. And it's actually the number of boats or the number of lipoproteins that's the main driving factor in heart disease. So LDL cholesterol, or LDL-C, that's on the standard lipid panel. That measures how much cholesterol is within the LDL particles. And then HDL-C measures how much cholesterol is in high-density lipoprotein boats. Total cholesterol kind of combines the LDL, VLDL, and a bunch of other lipoprotein remnants into one score, but that's also just measuring the total amount of cholesterol the boats are carrying around. So that turns out to be not very relevant in the process of heart disease, and as I just said, it's the number of lipoproteins, the number of boats, that's really the driving factor, and that is not measured on a standard lipid panel.
Okay, so what do folks, and so it, so we need to find out how many of these boats, how many particles there are floating around, and maybe we'll talk about that test here in just a second. But as an example, like somebody, let's talk about the boats, like the LDLP, how many of them, and then let's talk about how you could have an LDL cholesterol of 100 and have relatively few particles,
right.
And then you could have a LDL cholesterol of 100 and then have a ton of these things.
Yeah.
So tell folks a little bit about what the LDL particle, you know, like what that test is, who offers that,
and then when did
testing for this get on your radar? Like how did this newer information kind of get on, on your side?
Yeah, really in the past couple of years, it's come up more. Earlier on, I wrote, you know, I was guilty of this. There was a lot of focus on LDL particle size,
right,
or lipoprotein particle size. So,
and remind folks what that means.
Right.
Like it does tell us something.
It does tell us something. So the lipoproteins aren't uniform in size. You can have some that are very small and very dense, and then you can have some that are intermediate density and volume, and then you can have others that are larger and lower density. And for those of you who have heard of the VAP test or the vertical autoprofile or other, you know, technologies for measuring particle size, there's pattern A and pattern B. And pattern A is means you have a whole bunch of large, fluffy LDL particles.
Theoretically low reactance.
Theoretically not as big of a risk factor for heart disease. And then pattern B would be that you have a bunch of small, dense LDL particles. And the idea was that these were more harmful, more likely to damage the endothelium and initiate the whole process of atherosclerosis. But more recent research has shown that there are a couple problems with that theory. There's no doubt that smaller, denser LDL particles can be a sign of something gone wrong. But in studies that controlled for LDL particle number, they found that the association between small, dense LDL and heart disease disappeared. So in other words, if they did a study and it only measured small, dense LDL particle number and heart disease, they found a correlation. But if they also measured just the number of all LDL particles, then the predictive value of small dense LDL particles disappeared. So what that suggests, of course, is that it's the total number of LDL particles, regardless of whether they're large and fluffy or small and dense, that's the most important factor. And getting back to your earlier question, how do we measure that? The gold standard for measuring that is a test called the NMR, or nuclear magnetic resonance test, and it's offered by a lab called LipoScience. It's the only lab that's FDA approved for determining LDL particle number, which is often referred to as LDL particle concentration. So you take that test, and the result comes back, and it tells you the number of LDL particles that you have, and that turns out to be the main driving factor in atherosclerosis, because it's a gradient-driven process, which means that the more particles that you have floating around in your bloodstream, the more likely it is that some of them are going to migrate into the endothelium, damage it, and start this process of plaque formation.
So it's just kind of a statistical gig. Like even though small, dense LDL may be more reactive, even large, puffy LDL particles, at some point, if we have enough of them, just statistically, we're going to cause some damage to the endothelium, get some inflammatory response, and then
we're off and running. Okay. And that's one of the big holes in the theory of that large buoyant LDL was not a problem, is that people with a condition called familial hypercholesterolemia, which is a genetic problem that we'll probably talk about in a few minutes here, where people produce they have a much higher number of LDL particles than someone without that condition. Well, people with this condition have a whole bunch of particles, and they're mostly large, buoyant LDL particles. But they have a 3 times greater risk of heart disease than someone without that. So even though all of their LDL particles are large and fluffy, they're still having, you know, they have a 300% higher risk of heart disease.
Right. So, but interestingly, lower rates of infectious disease, lower rates of cancer, which is, again, this trade-off about cholesterol having some benefit with the innate immune system and stuff like that, and why we don't want to drive cholesterol down to 0 or 70 or
that's
some
right.
interventions.
I'm gonna bust your chops here and make you say lipoproteins instead of cholesterol.
Okay, true. I need to clean it up.
No, I mean, I'm half joking, but it actually, I'm trying to be more precise in my terminology, because what you were just referring to is that LDL, low-density lipoprotein, as you've talked about before, has antimicrobial properties, so it's very important in the immune system, which is why people with familial hypercholesterolemia have lower rates of infection. We also see, on the other side of that spectrum, that infection can raise both lipoprotein number and the amount of cargo in the boats, because the immune system will ramp up LDL production when there's an infection, or even when there's leaky gut and endotoxins escape from the gut where they should stay into the bloodstream. So it's an important point.
I think at various points we've talked in the podcast about that the lipoproteins actually sop up or attach to the lipopolysaccharide. And in all vertebrates, there's this potent inflammatory response to LPS, lipopolysaccharide. It's some of these glycated proteins that are on the outside of like E. coli and various bacteria. And our systems have a wicked response to that. And it can turn into systemic sepsis, but it also tends to look a whole lot like type 2 diabetes. You get this elevated blood glucose level, elevated triglycerides, this feed-forward mechanism of the liver still producing gluconeogenesis despite the high blood glucose levels.
Yeah.
And that might be something that's going on at a low-grade level with chronic infection.
Yeah, I think so. And, I didn't put this into the high cholesterol action plan as a potential cause of high cholesterol because there's not quite enough research on it yet. I wanted this to be absolutely bulletproof, so any mainstream physician could go through it and check all the references and it would be absolutely rock solid. But I think that's actually a really exciting frontier of research, this connection between leaky gut and high cholesterol,
right,
and leaky gut being a cause of high cholesterol in certain people. But let's get back to your earlier question and kind of tie this all together. So it's kind of crude to extend the analogy this way, but if we go back to the rivers and boats analogy, if you've got a river and it's absolutely full of boats and it's so crowded in the river that the boats can't even navigate, some of them might try to go in and dock in the shore. And that's basically what's happening in the artery. If there's so many LDL particles, just because of the gradient-driven process, some of them are going to penetrate the endothelial lining, which is extremely thin and fragile. It's one cell thick on the exterior, so it can be easily damaged by these LDL particles. So that's how the number of LDL particles is the most significant risk factor. Getting back to the standard lipid panel, here's the big problem. And I really feel like if your listeners only take away one thing from this show, this should be it. It's possible to have a high number of LDL particles and a normal or even low LDL and total cholesterol. And that person would be at high risk for heart disease. And they would be missed by the conventional standard testing. So this is someone, they go in to the doctor runs the standard lipid panel and maybe just total cholesterol and LDL and HDL. And they look at total cholesterol, maybe it's 180. They look at LDL, maybe it's 90 or 100 or something. And they say, oh, great, you're under the limit of 199 for total cholesterol and you're under the limit for LDL. You've got a clean bill of health. Come back next year. But that person could have an LDLP or LDL particle concentration of 1,500 or even 2,000, and they'd be like in the highest risk category for heart disease, and they wouldn't even know it.
And these are the people that, like maybe looking back, like Jim Fix and some of these people that were young, fit, maybe eating a pro-inflammatory diet, but probably had some other elements to this where the conventional testing, they looked pretty solid. Mm-hmm. But then, some of these people, we don't have the LDLP to look back at, but we're definitely seeing that. Just for folks also for reference, this LDLP test and the LipoScience test, this is what the Reno Risk Assessment Program uses after people have been flagged as discordance, like they have something going on, either metabolic derangement or some other type of problem that kind of raises a flag, and then we send some advanced testing down, and then we're going to hopefully at some point in the show we'll talk a little bit about Chris's involvement with the risk assessment program and some CME CEU stuff with his material.
Yeah, let's talk about discordance. I'm glad you brought that up because I think this is a really important concept in all this. So what Rob was just referring to when he said discordance was exactly what I had just explained, where you have someone with normal or even low total and LDL cholesterol, but high LDL particle number. So, of course, discordance is when you have two variables that aren't tracking each other concurrently. There are a couple people that this tends to be there's one main group of people that this is more common in, and those are people with some kind of metabolic derangement. So they might have high triglycerides or low HDL or both. And the reason for this is that the LDL particles can only carry a given amount of cholesterol, right? And so and a given amount of triglycerides. So if you have very high number of triglycerides, then your liver is going to have to make more LDL particles in order to carry that amount of triglyceride. And So your LDL particle number will increase, and the amount of cholesterol in each of the particles will decrease because that cholesterol is spread out over a greater number of LDL particles.
Basically diluted by the,
that's
the
right.
triglycerides.
So they're triglyceride rich but cholesterol poor. And that's why when you measure the LDL cholesterol or total cholesterol, it's low, which appears to be a good thing.
Right.
But if you know how this works, that could actually be a very bad thing. So my greatest concern in all of this is that people are going into the doctor and they're getting tested and they're coming away thinking they're not at risk, but they actually are at risk. Now, there's the other side of this coin, which are people who go in and get tested and they have high total and LDL cholesterol, but low LDL particle number. And they're not really at significant risk, but they're going to be overtreated
right.
by the doctor because there's this, you know, this old notion that it's all about the amount of cholesterol in the particle that matters.
So if you're that person, I mean, is this something where just in general you would recommend this this NMR testing to kind of ferret out what's going on? I mean, if the person presents with high total cholesterol, high LDL cholesterol, but low triglycerides, like they're really not showing signs and symptoms of metabolic derangement. Their triglyceride to HDL ratio doesn't look bad. Like, you know, they're not carrying, abdominal adiposity. They don't have high blood pressure. Then should that person seek out an NMR test to maybe keep their doctor from throwing them on statins or you know, just maybe have a little more negotiating?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I certainly don't think there's any harm in doing it. I mean, especially if your doctor will order it. And even if they won't, you can now get them through places like directlabs.com or privatemdlabs.com. These are LabCorp affiliates that the general public can order tests through. But there's a couple of ways to answer that question. So in the High Cholesterol Action Plan, I kind of break down what the four major red flags would be if you went in to get the test. And we've been here talking about all the deficiencies of the standard lipid panel, but there actually are a few. There are ways that you can use the numbers on that panel to predict whether you're likely to have elevated LDLP. Mm. So there are four criteria here. One would be, if your total cholesterol is above 290 milligrams per deciliter, I do recommend that someone goes ahead and gets the NMR because what that could indicate is familial hypercholesterolemia, which we can come back to. So even though total cholesterol itself isn't necessarily a problem, if the total cholesterol is very high like that, it suggests that familial hypercholesterolemia might be present. And the problem there isn't the cholesterol per se, but it's the increased particle number. So that's number one. Number two would be the ratio of total cholesterol to HDL. Now, this turns out to be a fairly accurate predictor of LDL particle number in some people. It is an accurate predictor in people let me back up. It's an accurate predictor of LDL particle number, and it's a fairly accurate predictor of metabolic derangement because if the total cholesterol is high and the HDL is very low, it's likely that that person also has elevated triglycerides, mm-hmm. you know, which would be another sign of metabolic derangement and a sign that the liver is having to work hard and produce extra LDL particles.
Right.
So if your total cholesterol to HDL ratio, and you just get that by dividing total cholesterol by HDL, is above 4.0, then it's likely that there's some discordance going on there and that you might have elevated LDLP. So that's a way that you can use numbers that are on the standard lipid panel to predict that the LDL particle number. The third would be triglycerides themselves, and that would be if you're above 125 milligrams per deciliter, that is basically where discordance starts. So if you look at these charts that show LDL particle number and LDL cholesterol, you see that they travel together up until about when triglycerides get to 125. And then LDL particle number will continue to go up and LDL cholesterol starts to go down.
Hmm.
That's where that phenomenon starts, where
you're saturated enough with triglycerides that it starts displacing the cholesterol,
right.
and the liver needs to upregulate production of,
that's
of
right.
Lipoproteins. Okay.
So if you have triglycerides above 125, that's another sign that discordance might be present. And then finally, if your HDL is below 40, That's another sign of discordance. So if any of those four markers are present, then I suggest that someone goes ahead and does the NMR.
So, for me, for ages, I kind of felt like if you were eating paleo, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card for right. cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. And so, I think it's obviously an improvement off of the standard American diet, but we're seeing some people pop up with some profiles that, I can't credibly say that anymore. So, yeah. What do you feel like is going on? We've talked a little bit about iron overload. Mm-hmm. There's some potential that leaky gut is an issue in this. Typically, when people start eating paleo, we see improvements in gut health. Like, what exactly right. is the mechanism, do you think, that's going on with some of this
yeah.
stuff?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to answer that question. One of the things I like to say is that high cholesterol is a symptom, not a disease. And that means that when cholesterol is high, there's almost always some underlying process that's driving it. And there are essentially four, there are more than four possibilities, but there are four primary reasons that this can happen. One is genetics, and this particularly this genetic condition called familial hypercholesterolemia, and also ApoE genotype, which we can come back to again. And number two would be poor thyroid function, because thyroid hormone, T3, is required to activate the LDL receptor, which takes LDL particles out of the circulation. So imagine someone that has poor thyroid function. Doesn't even have to be frank clinical hypothyroidism. It can be subclinical. There are a lot of studies that show that just subclinical hypothyroidism can cause this problem. The third would be infection. So we know that H. pylori, the bacterium that causes ulcers, can raise cholesterol. We know that viral infections like cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr virus, which are very common, herpes, can raise cholesterol. And we know that gut infections can raise cholesterol as well. And then the fourth cause is metabolic derangement, which we've already discussed, that high triglyceride, low HDL, insulin-resistant kind of pattern. And it's important to point out here that this it's more prominent in people who are overweight or obese, but I have plenty of patients who are quite lean and still have this pattern. They still have insulin resistance and elevated LDL particle number. So in terms of how this all relates to the paleo diet, there are a few possible scenarios. So let's say someone's eating a kind of standard so-called healthy diet according to the, Dean Ornish types, right. Fairly low fat, grain, lots of grains, stuff like that. And then they switch to paleo and they're eating like a pretty low carb, higher fat diet. And let's say this person had FH, familial hypercholesterolemia. Well, on that previous diet, even with FH, their cholesterol, their LDL particle number and their LDL cholesterol would have remained pretty low because they just weren't eating anything that was going to elevate their cholesterol. And then they switch to a diet where they're eating foods that could potentially increase their cholesterol. And for someone who doesn't have FH, it's not going to have a significant effect. But for someone who does, then their cholesterol shoots through the roof. So that's one possible scenario. Another possible scenario is, let's say someone switches to a really low-carb paleo diet, like under 50 grams a day, and they already had some pre-existing susceptibility to thyroid dysfunction. And so that kind of gets exacerbated by this long-term, really low-carbohydrate diet, which can impair thyroid function in certain people, not everybody. And so then because their thyroid function is declining, their cholesterol goes up. Those are, two possible scenarios.
And then if we throw, particularly on the thyroid side of that, if we throw a lowish carb, lots of training, lots right. of stress, like CrossFit-esque type of deal, right. then this is really exacerbating the problem because we are seeing a elevated cortisol and kind of tapping into that glycolytic pathway with inadequate carbohydrate.
That's right.
It's going to be a problem.
Right. So insulin is required for T4 to convert into T3. So if you have really chronically low insulin levels because you're not eating any carbohydrate, your conversion is going to be impaired, number one. And then if you're overtraining, your cortisol levels might go up at first, but eventually they go down. And cortisol is an anti-inflammatory hormone. So if your cortisol levels are low, you can't turn off the inflammatory process. So you go and you do a really intense workout. That's a catabolic process, an inflammatory state that's induced on purpose.
Right.
Because normally, in someone who doesn't have low cortisol, you know, you'll get back into an anabolic state and the muscles will build back bigger. That's the whole point, right? But if you have low cortisol, you don't come back to baseline. You stay in that catabolic state, and those inflammatory cytokines suppress the conversion of T4 to T3.
So you have dual mechanisms that could be suppressing the thyroid.
Yeah, so those are a couple issues there. You know, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between cholesterol in the diet and saturated fat in the diet and blood cholesterol and blood lipids, because this kind of gets at the main question you're asking about the paleo and how does paleo affect cholesterol. Well, for 75% of people, the amount of the cholesterol that they eat in the diet has absolutely no effect on blood cholesterol levels. So they could eat 6 eggs a day and their cholesterol wouldn't go up. And this is where the cholesterol skeptics are correct. You know, it really doesn't matter how much cholesterol you eat in the diet for the vast majority of people. But there are 25% of people who are what are known as hyper-responders, which means that they have a mild increase in their cholesterol from eating cholesterol in the diet. But here's the thing. Generally, you see an increase in both LDL and HDL, which means that the ratio that we were talking about before, total to HDL cholesterol ratio, doesn't change.
So it's kind of a wash.
It's kind of a wash. I don't think it's clinically significant. Then we have saturated fat, and it's a similar phenomenon. I don't have exact numbers because I've never seen a study with exact numbers, but we know that short-term studies show that eating saturated fat does raise cholesterol in the blood, and that was where the confusion started, is all the early studies were short-term. So this whole idea that saturated fat raises cholesterol came from those short-term studies. But longer-term studies have shown that for the majority of people, eating saturated fat does not affect your blood cholesterol levels. Again, though, there's a group of hyper-responders who, when they eat saturated fat, their blood cholesterol levels go up. And it's not completely clear now whether their LDL particle number is going up or whether they're just their LDL cholesterol, you know, gotcha, the amount of cargo in the boat. But I can tell you just anecdotally from my practice that some patients do experience an increase in particle number from eating.
So like coconut oil and
yeah. And this is where it gets a little tricky because for someone, the normal treatment for metabolic problems would be a high-fat, low-carb diet.
Right.
And in people who have that pattern of metabolic derangement, the low-carb, high-fat diet might actually bring their particle number down. But in someone with familial hypercholesterolemia, it might have the opposite effect. A low-carb diet in that case might actually increase their particle number. And I've seen that happen a few times.
So somebody has FH, familial hypercholesterolemia, and they have metabolic derangement. What do we do to fix these people? I mean, this is, you know, we were talking earlier this morning, like people are sleeping on average like 6.5 hours
right,
a night. And so I'm starting to think more and more, and obviously we've talked tons about sleep in the past, but mm-hmm. I'm just thinking more and more if people were to sleep 9 to 10 hours a night, would they respond to gluten as badly? Would they respond to dairy
right,
as badly? Like, would 90% of the problems that we see be as bad if we had a giant power outage for a year and people had to sleep,
right,
you know? So, but what do you do for that FH person who also has metabolic derangement?
Yeah.
Like, what's the order of operations
it's
on
a good,
that?
It's a good question. And the answer to that depends a lot also on what they're doing already. And, you know, for example, if that person's on a standard American diet, not training, you know, hasn't addressed gut issues, is not sleeping, is totally stressed out. I mean, I think obviously we address all of those things first. We get them on a moderate carbohydrate diet in
so
that case.
So kind of Katavan looking?
Yeah, something like, you know, maybe between 100 and 150 grams of carbs a day.
Okay.
From starch, you know, starchy tubers and fruit. Something like that. It will vary from person to person, but you don't want to go too high carb because that could increase, you know, triglycerides and that would of course increase particle number. You don't want to go too low carb because that could also drive up LDL particle number via a different mechanism if they're hyper responders to saturated fat, for example.
And probably more monounsaturated fats like olive oil,
coconut
oil, avocados.
Yeah, I would say, you know, lowering the saturated fat content a little bit and increasing monounsaturated, like you're saying. You could almost think of it as like a Mediterranean paleo diet,
right,
or something like that.
Right.
And then you'd want to rule out any thyroid problems, because a lot of times those might be present in people like that.
So talk to folks about that. Like, what is the, you know, lots and lots of people go to their doc. They even some of the people that we've seen in the risk assessment program that flagged as potential familial hypercholesterolemia. When I've done a little bit of digging, their thyroid, their TSH looked suspect.
Right.
And thyroid issues can look almost identical to FH,
sure,
because you still have large buoyant LDL particles, but the count may be elevated.
That's right. Yeah. So we might have to do another show on the thyroid, but I'll give you a kind of basic rundown on some of the issues. So one of the main things is that the lab range for TSH is too broad.
Okay.
You know, it varies from place to place, but usually it's about 0.45 to 4.5 or even as high as 5. And so if you go to a conventional doctor and your TSH is 4.3, they'll say your thyroid's fine, you know, and hustle you out the door. But
Chris Kresser land, of course, is screwed.
Not only my land, but actually the American Society of Clinical Endocrinologists, you know, this is a fairly mainstream organization. Mm-hmm. Their range is 1.8 to 3.
Wow. Okay.
So much narrower range. And you know, a lot of functional medicine clinicians like myself, we use that range because if someone's got a TSH of 4.2 or 4.3, that's not indicative of good thyroid function. So that's number one. You need to use the narrow range of TSH, which stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, for those of you that don't know. And the way this works is that there's a pretty elaborate system for regulating hormone levels of any kind, but particularly thyroid hormone here. And it starts up in the brain. And the pituitary measures, just sort of monitors the amount of thyroid hormone in the circulation, kind of like a control tower. And if the level of thyroid hormone is low, it will bump up the production of thyroid stimulating hormone, which basically then travels down to the thyroid, knocks on the door and goes, hey, pick things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
If thyroid hormone is too high, then the opposite thing happens. The pituitary will make less TSH. So it's a negative feedback cycle. And just so, you know, for everyone who doesn't already know this, high TSH actually indicates low thyroid function.
Because it's trying to goose this.
That's
and
right.
Make thyroid kick
over. It's an inverse marker.
Okay.
And then we need to be concerned with T4 and T3. And this is another problem with standard testing, is a lot of doctors will only measure TSH. They won't even measure T4, much less T3. But they'll just measure TSH, and if TSH is in the range, that's the end of the story. But we need to look at T4, which is the main hormone produced by the thyroid gland. About 93% of what the thyroid gland makes is T4. And even more importantly, we need to look at T3 because even though the thyroid gland doesn't produce much T3, it's the most active form of thyroid hormone. It's about 5 times more active metabolically than T4. And this is where it gets kind of interesting, is the conversion of T4 to T3 doesn't happen in the thyroid gland. It happens outside of the thyroid gland in the gut, 20% in the gut, 20% in the liver, and the rest in other peripheral tissues.
Hmm.
So you could have fairly normal thyroid function, fairly normal production of T4, but really poor conversion of T4 to T3, and you're kind of screwed, because that T3 is what activates the LDL receptor. So the things that impair conversion of T4 to T3 are stress, inflammation, and selenium deficiency, and chronically low insulin levels. Those are probably the 4 main causes. So if you go to the doctor, see if you can get your TSH and your T4 and your T3 tested, and at the risk of getting a little overly complicated here, we also need to look at the free levels of these hormones, free T4 and free T3. Most hormones, when they're produced by the gland, they're bound to a protein, because hormones are fat soluble and can't be transported through the blood, which is a, you know, water-based medium. So they need to be bound to a protein carrier. And as long as they're bound to this protein carrier, they can't actually activate the receptors and do everything that they're supposed to do. And so when they get to where they need to get to, that protein carrier gets cleaved off, and then this hormone is called free hormone or unbound hormone. So I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of free testosterone versus total testosterone. It's the same idea with thyroid hormones. So to really know how your thyroid's functioning, you need to measure your free T3, because that's ultimately the end product of all of the conversion. That's the bioactive thing. And so even, some clinicians will measure total T4 and total T3, and they're not measuring free T3. You're still not getting the full picture. So it is a little complex, but if you find a good practitioner, an endocrinologist who knows their stuff, I mean, nothing we're talking about here is going to be outside of their
controversial
wheelhouse.
At all. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, with the high cholesterol action plan, this was just kind of a response to more and more people that were, obviously paleo's growing. It appears to benefit a ton of people for a variety of things, from like gut health, autoimmunity, et cetera. But then some people are seeing some elevated cholesterol in general, possibly some elevated lipoproteins. And so this basically is a guide to help people both navigate through all that curriculum and also figure out some treatment strategies. So, so walk people through a little bit of what is in the program.
Great. Yeah. So you're exactly right. I mean, for me, this was actually pretty personal. I had a family member come. This has happened a number of times, and say, hey, I was diagnosed with high cholesterol. They know I do this for a living, and they want to talk to me about it. And I just realized I had nothing, I didn't have them a book or a video or anything that I could send them that would just concisely explain everything that they needed to know so that they could make an informed decision about their treatment.
You didn't want to send them to the National Lipid Association and 800 hours
of lectures, and they'd leave there with their eyes rolling back in their head. And nor could I sit down and talk to them for 7 hours, about it. There's nothing out there that would be a good resource that has all of the information that they need without overwhelming them, and practical tips for what you actually do once you figure out what your risk is. There are lots of good resources that are really heavy on the academic side, and if you know how to read them, you can figure this stuff out, but then they don't go into actual treatment above and beyond statins.
Like Peter Attia's site, he's done a great job describing LPPLA and all that stuff, but there's no treatment site on it, and that is pretty laborious to get through, too.
Yeah, I mean, Peter is brilliant. Right. And, for the people that made it through that series, it's probably about 0.5% of the people listening to this show, because it's pretty dense, So, I wanted to make something a little bit more accessible and more practical. So what it is it's a 9-week course, and it's about 5.5 hours of video, multimedia video presentation, broken down into 9 weekly modules. And I purposely done it this way. I deliver one module a week because I've learned in the past that if you just lay 5.5 hours of super dense content all at once, it can just be completely overwhelming. And so it's a sequential course that allows people to kind of digest and absorb the material as they're going through. I have PDF transcripts for people who prefer reading, like myself, for example. I never watch video. I'm way too time pressed for that. MP3 recordings of all the presentations for folks who like to listen to it on their iPhone or their Android. Then I've got a step-by-step action plan, which is kind of a decision tree graph where I take you through exactly what tests you should get, how to interpret the results, and then ultimately how to evaluate your risk of cardiovascular disease based on the test results. And then you get dropped into one of 4 treatment protocols based on those particular results. So the first 4 weeks of the program are really about how to calculate your risk. And, we have to keep in mind that this isn't a black and white process here. We can't say you've got a, 73% risk of dying from a heart. We're not there yet. But we can get a really good idea of risk based on what we know from the current literature. So in part 1 and 2, we talk about how heart disease develops. We go over a lot of the stuff we've been talking about now. We talk about the main underlying causes of heart disease and then also the main causes of oxidative damage of the lipoproteins, which we haven't gone into. Week 3 and 4, we talk about how to determine your risk of heart disease. So we talk about the standard lipid panel in some more detail, and then we talk about the NMR, how to measure your LDL particle concentration and some other markers on the NMR that we haven't discussed in this show. And then we talk about some of the more advanced tests like lipoprotein little a, C-reactive protein, LPPLA2, homocysteine, iron panel with ferritin, which Rob alluded to earlier. Iron overload is actually a little known risk factor for heart disease. We talk about blood sugar markers because, of course, if someone's got metabolic issues, they're going to have blood sugar problems. We need to fix that. We talk about calcium scans and the pros and cons of that test. And then in week five, that's when we start talking about what you actually do about this stuff. So I talk about a heart-healthy diet and lifestyle. And, of course, the paleo primal diet is the base of that. But I go into a lot more detail about specific tweaks that you can make to make it more heart healthy.
So like if somebody is showing iron overload potential, then we might minimize red meat for that individual, go more like fish and chicken and stuff like
That's right. So I'm sure a lot of you know that I'm a big fan of organ meats in general. I'm always encouraging people to eat liver, but if someone is iron loaded, liver is the last thing they want to be eating because it's going to increase their iron, and iron is a powerful catalyst of free radical production. And then there are studies that show that people that have elevated LDL particle number have, you know, an increased risk of heart disease. People who have elevated iron saturation, which is a measure of iron overload, have also increased risk. But when you put elevated iron saturation and elevated LDL particles together, their increase of heart disease goes up by about 500%.
Because we have that oxidative stress affecting the LDL particles.
That's right. So then We talk a lot about basic micronutrient repletion, supplementation, you know, basic nutrients that I think everyone needs to be doing to protect against heart disease. We talk about exercise, and we particularly exercise for cardiovascular risk management, which is a little bit different than it might be for, like, you know, increasing your performance, for example. And then we talk about stress management, which is crucial. And then week seven is really all about statins, and maybe we should talk a little bit about statins if we have a moment. So statins, the operative question that we should all be asking about statins is, how do they work, who do they work for, and how do they work for those people? Because it's not enough to just say statins do this or don't do this. We have to be very specific about the populations, because as it turns out, they have really different effects and really in different populations. So for example, statins have never been shown to increase lifespan in people, even at moderate to high risk of heart disease, that don't already have heart disease. They do reduce heart attacks and strokes in that population, but, you know, we're talking about healthy people at high risk of heart disease. Statins have never been shown to increase lifespan. I think it's important for people to know that.
Right.
I'm not saying that reducing heart attacks is something we should ignore. That is an important outcome, although it's actually statins are much less effective at doing that in healthy people than a lot of people assume. But I think most people who are prescribed a statin by their doctor just assume that it's going to protect, it's going to reduce their chances of dying prematurely, right? And that's why a lot of people end up taking them. But the truth is, statins have never been shown to do that in healthy people without pre-existing heart disease. Another population that doesn't benefit from statins in terms of reducing their life or extending their lifespan are women. And this is true not only in women without pre-existing heart disease, but also women with heart disease. Once again, statins do reduce heart attacks and deaths from heart disease in that population, but they don't extend lifespan even by a single day, according to the current research. So we go into a lot of detail about statins and how they, you know, all the various populations, how effective they are. And then we talk about side effects and risks of statins, and we talk about how to minimize those side effects and risks if you are taking a statin. And let me just be clear that, you know, I've been critical about statins in the past, and I think they're overprescribed, but there are certain populations that I think can.
Hey, folks, just a little sound issue there, but we are back. So, Chris, you were talking about statins.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I've been critical of statins in the past, and I am still critical of them when they're prescribed in situations where the evidence doesn't support their use. But that doesn't mean I think statins are, you know, horrible across the board and shouldn't ever be used. I do think there may be certain circumstances where statins make sense, particularly in patients with familial hypercholesterolemia. So in Module 8, in Week 8, I talk about a lot of natural ways to reduce lipoprotein particle number that are evidence-based, and also to reduce the potential for oxidation of the lipoprotein particle, which is another main risk factor for heart disease. But my purpose in the statin module and overall on the plan is just to help you make an informed choice with your doctor about whether statins are right for you. My goal isn't to tell you to take a statin or not take a statin. It's to just educate you about what the evidence says on statin efficacy in various populations and what they do and don't do in those populations so that you can make an informed choice. And then, as I just mentioned, in Week 8, we talk about natural prevention. There are things like delta and gamma tocotrienols and pantothene and fish oil that can reduce LDL particle number and also other risk factors for heart disease. And then we talk about some therapies that can reduce the potential for oxidative damage. So this is above and beyond the basic micronutrient support we talked about back in Week 6. And then finally, in Week 9 is when we bring it all together. Everything we've covered in the plan up until now comes together in this decision tree format where I take you step by step through all the tests you need to get, how to interpret the results, and then how to determine your risk of heart disease, and then what treatment protocol you would end up in based on your particular test results. And then I lay out the treatment protocols for each of those levels with specific recommendations for diet and lifestyle and basic supplementation, and then, you know, more specific supplementation, and then an evaluation of statins and whether they might be right for you in that situation, and then what to do if you decide to take them to reduce or mitigate the risk of side effects. And there's a lot of handouts and kind of cheat sheets and worksheets that are included with each of the modules. So, you know, for quick reference, so you don't have to go back and wade through the presentation to, you know, get the top line info. And then we've got some great bonus material, interviews with weight loss experts like Stephan Guillenet and sleep experts like Dan Party, and, you know, some ancillary stuff that helps kind of support the overall heart healthy diet and lifestyle.
Nice. So, for folks that have been, maybe you received some basic blood work, things didn't come back the way that you might think that you would have liked to see it. Your doc maybe, you know, is concerned about what appears to be some bad blood work. Again, this plan will help you kind of navigate through and figure out, okay, do I have elevated cholesterol or do I have elevated lipoproteins? If I have elevated lipoproteins, what are my other risk factors like metabolic derangement, potential thyroid dysregulation? You don't get into the gut health specifically in this. That's more personal paleo code. And then also you're going to have some work down the road looking more at the gut. But but this thing will allow somebody who maybe has some questions about whether or not they're in a good spot with cardiovascular health to be able to make some informed decisions about advanced testing, what that advanced testing means, then be able to sit down with your doc and then make some decisions about, like, okay, even though my total cholesterol is high, my particle count is low, I have super good metabolic parameters, I don't have insulin resistance, so the likelihood of having cardiovascular disease is low. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we have something a little more murky in there. Maybe we have some familial hypercholesterolemia and we need to really think about, if you're following a paleo diet, that you need to do some modifications on that. You need mm-hmm. to follow more of like a Mediterranean paleo type diet that right. minimizes saturated fat. If you've got iron overload issues, then we need to actually avoid some red meat and donate some blood. Yeah. go do some bleeding. Mm-hmm. Greg Everett actually did an article on blood donation for the performance menu back in 2005, 2006, which mm-hmm. is a very, very good yeah. article. So Chris, how do folks track this thing down?
Yeah. It's at highcholesterolplan.chriscresser.com, and you can learn more about the program there. I go into a lot more detail about what's in the modules and what the program consists of. And I think that's about it.
Cool. And Chris, tell folks really quickly, like, Chris shot over to Reno. We got to hang out a little bit. We've been elbow deep in kids and diapers and all kinds of stuff. But part of the part of the trip was Chris did some talking and showed some of his modules to the folks at Specialty Health. So what's going to be happening with your modules now with regards to CMEs and CMUs?
Yeah, that's exciting. I'm glad you brought that up. This is a great program, not only for patients, consumers, whatever you want to call it, people who are just concerned about their cholesterol. It's a great program for clinicians or anybody that works with clients or patients as a healthcare practitioner, health coach, nutritionist, acupuncturist, chiropractor, medical doctor, whatever. So one of my goals was to get this certified for continuing medical education, CME, and continuing education units so that people, you know, folks who are professionals could take this course and actually get credit for it. And that's what we discussed in the meeting with Specialty Health. They were really excited about it, and they're going to get it certified for CME and CEU units. And then they're also going to offer it as part of their risk assessment program, which I think you've talked about a lot on the show.
Yeah, we will be rolling out a direct-to-consumer blood testing, a basic panel initially, kind of doing very similar to what we do with the police and firefighters, doing a basic panel. And then if we see some lab values that would indicate the need for advanced testing, then that's where we would recommend going with a LipoScience for the NMR, and then the Specialty Health will be offering some health coaching, basically providing interpretation of what these lab values mean, so that, again, you could go back and work with your doctor, work with your primary care provider to do some follow-up when and where necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, so super cool stuff. Keep your eyes open on that. Definitely check out Chris Kresser's High Cholesterol Action Plan. You also have chriskresser.com, of course. Your podcast is available on there. I think that's most of the stuff. Can you think of anything else that folks need to check out?
No, I think that covers it.
Cool. Well, the babies, I hear them screaming in the background. So I think Chris and I are going to be on a short leash now. But folks, definitely check out the High Cholesterol Action Plan. Thanks for coming and hanging out, dude.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So everybody have a good time, and give me some feedback on the, you know, what how many of you are checking this thing out. Definitely, I know a number of people have shot me questions about cholesterol lately. So give this thing a look-see, and we'll catch y'all at episode 152. And Greg Everett will be back for that. I know some people missed his warm, snuggly self, so he will be back. Talk to y'all soon.